Hello, and a really warm welcome to our podcast, Successful Student Transitions, A Time to Thrive, hosted by Louise Wiles and me, Elizabeth Gillis. And in our podcast, we aim to be a companion for young people as they step out of school into the world of work and study and help them thrive in new environments. And we've had a focus recently on the first year of university students, hearing what it's like for them to be in that first term. And this second term, which is likely about now if you're listening, brings another transition into exams, with assessment being different of what's happened before in school that they might have been used to. So we're viewing this as another transition into perhaps a different structure, a pace, different routine in that first year of university. And we've done a couple of podcasts already, so if you want to go and listen back to that about exam stress and prep, go ahead. And today I'm welcoming, I can see Bradley Bush from Inner Drive. And I'm so happy and delighted that you could join us today, Bradley. Do you want to say hi and tell us a little bit about Inner Drive? What do you do?
Sure. Hi. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's always flattering to be invited. So yeah, about us and me at Inner Drive. I'm a psychologist by trade and been working with Inner Drive now about 16 or 17 years. We initially started in sport. We wanted to see if we could use psychological research to help footballers kick a ball better. And we still do a bit of that, and we've worked with some really amazing and talented Premier League players. But our main focus now really is in education, to see, can we use psychological research to help students know how to learn better? And can we work with their teachers and the parents to understand that process so that they can help facilitate that? We work with hundreds of schools all over the country. And we've also written a few books. So we have our student one is called Release Your Inner Drive. We also have a parent one called The Parent's Guide to the Science of Learning. And yeah, we kind of see ourselves as Google Translate for research. So we don't necessarily do research ourselves, but we try and illuminate other people's research, try and explain it and spread the message far and wide on brilliant podcasts such as these.
Thank you for that. And I really like the idea of you translating things, because often there's a lag, isn't there? There's a big lag between what's happening in research and the information that gets out there. And certainly I know that you're really working hard to get that information out there. And recently I attended one of your flash webinars, great, kind of short, very focused, and it was on student revision. And I would really kind of suggest, of course you're going to listen here today, but check out the website, check out their Instagram, look out for these flash webinars, because they're really worthwhile kind of listening to.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So we're going to talk today about sharing things for university students about studying exams. And just before we go into some tips that you've got, some research-based evidence tips about it, Why do you think that exams and study at university is quite hard for our young people?
So I think there's probably two things at the moment that really stand out the most to me. One is, I think, an age-old problem, and one's probably a quite newer one. So I think the age-old problem is, for the most part, people aren't very good at really knowing how to learn. We tend to confuse what we like and what we prefer with what's best for us. So I always kind of joke that, you know, my six-year-old kid, he likes chocolate chip cookies for breakfast. That's his preference. But as someone who's older and hopefully a bit wiser, I know that's not what's best for him. And so we often confuse what we like with what's best for us. And when it comes to learning, if that hasn't been explicitly taught to us in the past about how to learn, it's kind of up to trial and error if people pick it up and work out how to do that. And we can talk perhaps later about some of those strategies around what good studying and learning looks like. So I think that's quite an age-old problem. The more recent problem is, you can't get away from, we are still seeing the ripple effects from COVID of, if you take this group of students who are now at university or about to go to university, they've had less exposure to external examination. They've had less exposure and preparation around independent study, because for 2 years, everything was kind of in flux. And we obviously saw there was a significant learning loss that happened during the COVID years, but we're now seeing almost the secondary consequences that happens afterwards, even beyond just how to study. We've had a number of university lecturers tell us that seminar discussions have taken on a different dynamic in the last few years compared to pre-COVID, because that skill of developing how to disagree in person and hold debate was basically on pause. So I think the two things combined, as society, most people don't know how to learn really effectively, and also that being magnified with the COVID context that we're still in the shadow of. Yeah, I think that's why it's a really tough time for a lot of students.
Yeah, and I really agree with both of those things. And maybe another thing that I'd add is that I think when our young people are at school, it's very achievement focused, isn't it? And they're aiming to get A's and A stars, or, you know, that's what they're aiming. And when they go to university, well, that's likely not going to happen in that first year, for instance. They're not going to be gaining those big, you know, those top marks and things. And so there's a, I don't know what I would call it, maybe you've got a psychological term for it, but there's that kind of disappointment, or they kind of think, I'm not doing well if I'm not getting what I used to get. Yeah. Because it's a completely different system and a different way of working.
Oh, it's a hugely different system. Like, the support structure isn't there. When I was at university, and I had a really great time, but I'm pretty sure most of my lecturers didn't know my name. The ability to study independently and what you do outside lectures is a much more of an important skill. And if you haven't been exposed to that before, which some students haven't, that's a big culture shock.
Yeah, yeah. And so going from a place where you kind of know how to do it all to a place that's all new, like that transition stuff that we talk about, is really, you know, it's a good one to know that this is a different place that might need different set of skills. And knowing how to learn effectively, like, leads us really nicely and then to kind of think about how you do that.
Yeah.
Brad, kind of explain a couple of things to us about how to learn effectively. What kind of research would you share with us, and how we would put that into practice?
Yeah, well, so in terms of making it really clear and easy to process, but I think you can divide good learning and how to do it really well into two distinct categories. So the first one is, how do I improve like learning and memory specifically? And there's a couple of strategies which I'll chat about. And then the second part, it revolves more around sort of motivation and resilience, and how do I plan my time and that sort of area. So let's talk about part one. Let's do the memory stuff first. The best way I think about it is, there are a few fundamental learning principles that if you know the principle, it can take many forms. So for me, the first principle, and this often gets talked about in cognitive psychology, is there's this famous phrase by a brilliant researcher, a guy called Daniel Willingham, who says memory is the residue of thought. Or to put that into plain English, you have to think hard about stuff in order to remember it. So then the question becomes, what are the strategies that make me think hard? And consistently in the research, the number one, if anyone wanted to Google for more information, the technical phrase is known as retrieval practice, which basically involves having to generate an answer from memory actually improves that memory. And so for years, I think people have thought about quizzing, for example, the wrong way around. For years, people think you do a bunch of learning, and at the end, you do a quiz to assess how much you've learned, how your study's gone. But what the research actually suggests is, quizzing doesn't just assess the learning. Quizzing accelerates the learning. Like, quizzing is part of the learning process, because in order, when you quiz yourself, you're prompted to think hard, and that thinking hard improves your memory. So that can take many formats. It can be flashcards, tend to be really effective. It can be verbal question and answer with a friend, where you have to explain things from memory. It can be write down everything. Give you 5 minutes, write down everything you remember on that topic, because you're having to retrieve information. Now, a lot of the time, that's not the most intuitive of strategies, because there is this misconception. It's quite a big misconception, where people go, I don't need to remember stuff because I'll just be able to Google it. But there's many reasons why that doesn't work. It's actually called the Google effect, because it doesn't make you think hard. So you might be able to access that information, but you won't be able to retrieve it in exam conditions. And of course, there's a wealth of misinformation out there. So just relying on Google, you actually need to know stuff in order to know what to Google and what to understand. So for me, retrieval practice, this quizzing, multiple choice, flashcards, write down everything you remember, past papers, really, that is your best bet for me for learning. The second one, when it comes to...
it. I like that reinforcement that this is hard work.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of people don't naturally do it, because as human beings, and this is true for nearly everyone, our default is the path of least resistance. Like, why would I self-select to make myself have to think hard? Because that's uncomfortable. And ironically, it's that uncomfort that is the thing that's going to help the learning. If you didn't have to think hard, if everything was easy, your short-term performance might look good. Yeah, I got everything right. But the actual long-term learning, which is different, suffers. And it's the learning that's ultimately going to lead to better marks. Yeah.
And I was working with a student recently who's just gone to university. And he was talking to another student who was a mature student. And he said to the mature student, gosh, this is hard. And the mature student said, did you imagine it would be easy?
It's exactly that. Yeah. So like, if you think of anything in your life that you're proud of, an achievement that you've done, by definition, you were probably a bit nervous before you did it. So nerves aren't always a bad thing. And B, it probably did involve an element of struggle because you had to overcome in order to achieve. And therefore, things being difficult or challenging, often I think people, or some students might misrepresent that, almost think that as proof that they're not smart enough. Like, if I find it hard, therefore I must be dumb. Whereas actually, if you don't find it hard, you're probably not learning. So that's definitely, I think, the main principle. That's your best bet. That's the one I'd hang my hat on. The second one, when it comes to memory. So if that first principle was, if you think hard about it, you're more likely to remember it. The second principle is, anything you gain quickly, you lose quickly. So for example, I'll give you like a non-education example first. It's really popular now. I see a lot of people tell me when they learn to drive. You do this week-long driving intensive course, and you rock up on a Monday, you do 9 to 5, Monday to Friday driving lessons. So you get your 40 hours in the week, and then you take your test on the Saturday. And apparently the pass rates for this intensive course are brilliant. I think they advertise at like 90% pass rates. And yet, when you track those drivers for the first year, I had a few driving instructors tell me they think those students are more likely to be involved in crashes because they gain that knowledge quickly, so they lose the knowledge quickly. And so therefore, what we actually want to say, the technical term for this in the research is known as spacing, is it's actually really important to revisit material regularly. So doing little bits often, as opposed to a lot all at once. So on a very basic level, doing 1 hour a day for 7 days of revision is far better than doing 7 hours in one day, because you're more likely to remember it longer if it's taking you longer to accumulate. And so spacing is really important because it says you have to revisit material. So then the question becomes, why don't people naturally do this? And unfortunately, there's a few cognitive biases at play here, but the most pronounced one for me is, I think there's an overconfidence that comes from familiarity. So let's say I do a piece of work and I study it and I quiz myself afterwards and I remember it. It's really tempted to go, I've done that. I remembered everything when I quiz myself. So now I can just move on to the next thing and then the next thing. And we tend to overestimate how likely we are to remember the first thing. So we're not prompted to go back and revisit. But that revisiting is actually really, really important.
And it keeps it in that more working memory, doesn't it, as well at that time?
Well, yeah. So essentially what we're like, there's, it's really interesting as to what the mechanism is that allows spacing to work. Essentially, someone recently described to me is, if you learn something and then almost forget it, and then relearn it and almost forget it, that act of forgetting and relearning actually helps cement it in your long-term memory. So forgetting isn't always a bad thing. It's part of the learning process. So the equivalent is, if you go for a walk in a field with long grass, each time you do that walk, the path and the long grass gets a bit more embedded, a bit more ingrained. That's kind of not a bad metaphor for like the memory traces of that information.
Yeah, very nice. So it is hard work and it's doing it often.
Yes, a little bit often. Yes, very much so. So I think for me, that's your best bet for the memory side of things. Now you can get onto the other side, which is, what about the motivation to want to do this stuff in the first place? And we know there's some really nice research around, I guess, the barriers towards motivation and then what people can do about it. One big one is obviously procrastination. Research suggests that a large percentage of students self-identify as a procrastinator. Fascinatingly, there's lots of different reasons as to why that's the case. So some research looks as linking it to perfectionism. If I can't be amazing at it, I won't even start, is the kind of thought process. Some link it to feel failure. Mm-hmm. If I start, there's a chance I'm going to expose myself that I'm not as smart as I think I am, that I'll fail. It's even been linked to people who you identify as having a really strong rebellious streak tend to be more like to procrastinate. So there's many different reasons, but there are some things we know that you can do to help overcome it. One of the ones in the research is externally set short deadlines. So the equivalent, I guess, for me is when I'm at the gym, which definitely isn't enough, but when I'm on the treadmill, if I'm just running on the treadmill by myself, it's really easy to justify getting off. You can come up with a million different reasons and excuses. But if you have someone next to you who goes, I just want you to do this for 4 more minutes. You go, okay, fine, I'll do it for 4 more minutes. So like almost arbitrary short deadlines that are externally set, people then tend to plan and manage their time and emotion and energy a bit better. So we like externally short deadlines, tends to be not one of them. And that really leads on to this idea of what the researchers call the planning fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
So the planning fallacy describes how all of us, but I think it's probably magnified in students if I had to guess, we're not very good at estimating how long a task will take to complete. We tend to underestimate it. So if I think a piece of work will take less time than it actually does, because I think it takes less time, in my mind, that means I can start it later. But that starting it later then leads to this mad panic and stress. And ironically, leaves less time for spacing. Because if you start it later, you can't then revisit it as often. So you can see how the two kind of interlink a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. And I think when you were talking about setting those kind of goals externally, I think that's why having a study buddy is quite a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like having something.
And also, so there's this famous phrase that people sometimes might know is, they say, like, for example, effort is contagious.
Yes.
And the technical name in the research, there's some nice research that's called the Kohler effect, but basically says we're very influenced by other people in the group. This is not based on any research, this next part, but just kind of anecdotally, I had it described to me recently. They said, you are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. So if you spend time with 5 people who are lazy, who complain, who are really negative, it's really easy to internalize that sort of thought process, which is why study buddies are so important, but you have to choose them carefully.
Yeah.
And I think there is a time and place, having people in your orbit who make you laugh, who are really good, reliable, loyal friends, and it's enjoyable to be around them, are really, really important, I think, for emotional support. But when it comes to necessarily studying, they might not be the same people who are the best to work alongside. And the question is, who are the people that you know who work really hard? And even if you just go and sit next to them, it's a bit like, going back to my treadmill example, if I'm on the treadmill and some random guy gets on the treadmill next to me, if he goes that little bit faster than me, most people's natural reaction is, okay, I'm going to speed up then. We're having a race, whether you know it or not. So that effect other people can have on you can be a really positive one, almost like positive peer pressure when it's directed the right way.
So choose your study buddy carefully then.
Massively.
Yeah. Okay. And tell me, on the webinar, that the flash webinar I kind of attended, it was Matt. He talked about the NASA rocket. Explain that, because I think this is amazing. I love this idea.
Yeah. So where that came from, I've got family in Texas. And so we went to the NASA Space Center, that's kind of there. And when we got the tour, this is quite a few years ago, one of the tour guys was telling us that apparently when NASA launched a rocket into space, it burns more fuel in the first 2 minutes than it does for the rest of the journey combined. So it burns more fuel in the first 2 minutes than the whole of the rest of the other journey. And what that basically shows is getting started is the hardest part. Getting started requires the most effort, the most energy, and it's basically half the battle. And I've heard a few psychologists talk about how if you do a task for 10 minutes, he says, I'm just gonna do this for 10 minutes. If I wanna quit after 10 minutes or have a break, fine, I'll have a break. What they typically find though, is after 10 minutes, most people then go, oh, it wasn't as bad as I actually thought it was gonna be, I'll keep going. They've kind of got over that initial hump of just starting. And that's where that kind of that NASA analogy, I think, fits and works quite nicely. So like, if nothing else, just start the work. Just start the work early and like see how it goes. But that often builds positive momentum.
Yeah. And it's almost like you have to lean into that discomfort that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You have to be aware that starting anything can be hard, and that's the most difficult bit. And if you start and do it, likely you're going to continue. Yeah.
And that's why I see it in a lot of often quite high achieving students or students with elements of perfectionism is this reluctance to start. And I always kind of say, you don't need to edit your first draft whilst writing your first draft. Like, just get it out on paper, just start it. And then it's always easier to go, that was rubbish, I'll change that or I'll keep that. But if you have this constant fear of it needs to be perfect straight away, then you can see how that can lead some people then just never starting.
Can you say something a little bit too about, you know, I sometimes work with people and say, oh, it's really good that I've got play music and I'm kind of looking at my phone, I need my phone with me and I'm listening to music or I've got this on in the background. Talk to us a little bit about distractions when people are studying.
I'll separate them to music and phone. So sometimes obviously they can be combined because listen to music on their phone. But let's do music first. There is a wealth of evidence, like almost undeniable, that like music can improve your motivation. It's why people listen to it at the gym, because it can increase their heart rate and make them feel more motivated. Music can definitely affect your mood. Your favorite song tends to make you smile and laugh. But when it comes to learning, the research suggests that music, when it has lyrics, people tend to remember less if they study whilst listening to music that have lyrics. And you know this is intuitively true. If you yourself have ever been driving, if you've got a passenger in the seat next to you and you know where you're going, you can talk to them, you can have the radio on, listening to music. But as soon as you're lost, what's the first thing that everyone does when they're lost is they turn to the person next to them and they go, can you just shut up for a minute? I'll turn the radio off. And they literally say, because I need to think. Like, we know when you have to think hard, music that has lyrics competes for attention. And essentially, I don't want the lyrics getting into your head. I want the studying content to go in your head. So I'd strongly advise, again, it comes down to most people confuse what they like with what's best for them. We like listening to music because work is hard or boring sometimes, and I want it to be enjoyable. But enjoyable and fun is different to what's best for always for learning. So,
and a really nice distinction there, isn't it, about maybe listening to music helps you get through all this sort of stuff, but actually it is a distraction, isn't it?
Yeah. So like, when you don't need to think too much about it, so for example, we know that if you play music when people are working on a production line and you're doing the same task repetitively, then it's probably not a problem because you're not having to think really complex and cognitively challenging things. But when you're studying and you do need to think hard, that's when it becomes problematic. And the other one is mobile phones. So, yeah, I'm never sure if I should say it like this, but anyway, here goes. I don't think we should call them mobile phones. I think that's fundamentally the problem. Like, 99% of the time, they're not being used for phone calls. Like, we should call them actually what they are, which are devices that people use. If you look at all the research, they use them for gaming, for social media, for shopping, or for porn. And as people get older, gambling. Is typically like how we typically see a lot of how these devices, like one of those five things. And then the question is, does a device, if you call it that, if you don't call it a phone, but if you call it what it actually is, which is a distraction, does that sound like the sort of thing that can really help learning? Now, of course, you can make the argument, but you can look up information, you can share documents with friends or like stuff. And so there clearly is some learning gains to be had. So I'm not saying there's no learning gains. The question has to be, do the learning gains outweigh the learning losses when it comes to mobile phone? And almost certainly they don't. And, you know, I've seen some research that looked at, this is actually really cool. They had people go out to a restaurant and eat dinner, and they had their phone next to them when they ate. They weren't even using it. It was just sat on the table. And they found people, when they went to dinner, if their phone's out next to you, they rated the food as less tasty and the conversation as less interesting. We've also seen other studies that show if your phone's next to you, even if you're not using it, it reduces your concentration, because even if you're not using it, even now I'm looking at my phone next to me and I'm going, oh, I wonder if my wife has texted me back yet. After this podcast, I wonder what messages that I might have for my kid's school or whatever the thing is. So it competes for attention. And that's why the old adage, out of sight is out of mind, is really true. Your brain against the collective brains of Silicon Valley who've designed your phone, it's not a fair fight. Your brain's always going to lose it. And that's why the more you can revise without your phone next to you, chances are it'll be better for most students.
And going back to that thing, you might like it, but it might not be helping.
Yeah, exactly.
When we get a distraction, so, I mean, I guess there are internal and external distractions because we could be thinking, oh, I wonder what's coming up on my phone, or it could be a noise outside or somebody coming into the room or whatever. So when we have those distractions and we are doing the hard work, what's the impact on us?
So we know that when they get, they've done studies where students had to do self-report of how did you find the distractions. Overwhelmingly, students say distractions are really stressful. They rate that they have to work harder. It requires more effort to do a basic task when you have these distractions. And yet, given the choice, intuitively, most people tend to not block out the distractions. They keep their phones next to them. There was one really interesting study, it's kind of a seminal study in this area, that looked at how long on average did it take people to fully refocus after distraction. So to be clear, like you're doing a task, there's a distraction. How long does it take to you to get back in the exact same headspace, in the exact same zone before the distraction? And what the researchers found, it was incredible really, they reckon the number they placed on it was about 22 minutes on average to refocus. Now, why is that number so big? Two reasons. One, some people never return to their original headspace after the distraction. The distraction is then the trigger for them doing something else. So that's partly where. And another reason is, we always say like, distractions beget distractions. So let's say I'm sitting next to you and you're working hard and then I see you distracted by, you're on your phone. And then I go, oh, amazing, I can see Elizabeth isn't working hard right now. Now's a great time for me to tell her what I thought about Married at First Sight episode last night on TV. Like that's my in, because I've been waiting to tell you about the thing that I want to tell you. And so now you've got to deal with your initial distraction. You've then got to deal with my distraction. And then some distractions actually lead to you having to action something. Yeah. So you can actually see why these distractions beget distractions. And to return to the original headspace is quite time consuming.
I mean, 22 minutes is a long time, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when I heard that, when Matt was talking about it, I tested it out for myself.
Right.
And I think it's that thing that when you get distracted, I'm working on something, I get distracted and I often have to think, oh, there's a call from somebody, will I take it or won't I? Or there's a text, will I take it or not? And I'm making other decisions about doing that. And my head's gone off in this other place.
Oh, so much so. Even this morning, so I get distracted by my phone, I reply to the text message, I then go, probably is a good time to get a cup of tea. I go make a cup of tea. Someone sees me at the kettle in my office and they go, oh, I'll chat to Brad about something. And you can just see how it's just really hard. And I think one of the dangers and the challenges for students is, so luckily my generation grew up in a time where we didn't have as many distractions to hand. So like mobile phones only started becoming a thing in my late teenage years. And the biggest distraction on my phone at the time was the game Snake on the old Nokia 3210. Whereas now, at your fingertips, you have every possible distraction in the whole world that's ever been invented is basically at your fingertips. And it's just unfair to expect anyone not to be distracted if they're exposed to that stuff. So the answer comes then really in limiting the distractions that are available to you in the first place.
And I think that is such a wise thing to say in a world where, you know, a lot of young people in particular, and well, maybe all of us are, is this a strong word, addicted to our these, and I'm not going to call them mobile phones anymore. You've really helped me.
So in terms
of rethinking that, but we've been primed to lean into all this stuff that, you know, there's all this technology and money behind us being on these things.
So let's talk about, because the word addiction is a really interesting one. So let's look at, let me tell you, if you wake up in the morning and the first thing you do while you're still in bed is you have a drink of vodka, right? If you go to the toilet, I think that's a great time to sneakily have another drink. If the last thing you do before bed is to have another drink, if you can't bear the thought of not sleeping within a meter of your vodka bottle, we would legitimately say that person probably has an alcohol addiction. And that is exactly what is happening with people on their phones. I heard a great explanation for this the other day. I think this is brilliant. They talked about situational cues. So they say basically when you go into the bathroom in the morning, that situation cues you to go, I should brush my teeth because that's what I do here. Likewise, when I then go into the kitchen, I'll go, that's where I make my tea. So I'll go to the kettle here. Because mobile phones don't have a situation cue, they're everywhere. It basically leads to people going, nowhere is off limits to be on my phone. So now it becomes socially acceptable to have your phone out and be on your phone while you're out at dinner with friends. It's socially acceptable for some people, even to the extreme, to do it when driving, because in their mind, they're like, mobile phones can be used anywhere. Because they're not confined. And it's funny, I think growing up, my parents were worried about my generation being addicted to TV. Like, I don't want you watching TV for too long, right? Whereas now, if my child was to just watch TV and not be on his phone while watching TV, you'd go, oh, that's good. We were able to watch a film together because they weren't on their phone, because it's just the norm that they're everywhere. And that's quite scary, really.
And it is square. And also that word mobile means we can take it everywhere.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of clever marketing that goes into this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, you really made me
think. Oh, and even like the biggest killer is they're called smartphones.
Yes.
But they make you dumb. Like, they do actually make you dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we should need a campaign, Bradley, about trying to get rid of those words and call things as they are. I think that's a really good thing. Do you know, I think this conversation could go on and on. I've really enjoyed it. I like the idea of working hard, a little and often, and about how to kind of get ourselves in a good place, few distractions, launching ourselves to work. Some great things that you've talked today about.
So thank you.
I'm going to really suggest people lean into your the website and your resources in a drive. We'll put it up on our Instagram as well.
Thank you.
And Bradley, it's been a great conversation today. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely talking to you, Elizabeth.
So what a really great conversation. One that has definitely got me thinking, especially about the distractions and the addiction of our mobile accessories and computers. I'm going to be moving mine out of the room from now on when I have focused work to do. What about you? If you want to learn more about Bradley and his team, go to innerdrive.com. And the two books that he mentioned were Release Your Inner Drive for Students and The Parent's Guide to the Science of Learning. So here's a quick summary from the conversation today. So Bradley Bush from Inner Drive provides evidence-based strategies for students when studying for exams and assessments. The key things discussed today were: be aware that there's a difference between what we like to do when we're studying and what's effective. So how true is that? He reminded us that studying is challenging work and it isn't easy. He suggests that we find different ways to retrieve the knowledge that we need to remember and know in exam and assessment situations. He suggested that little and often is the best strategy, called spacing. It's an effective study strategy. Start your work early, as we often underestimate the time we need. Oh, how often I've been caught with that one. And remember, effort is contagious. So think about setting deadlines with a carefully chosen study buddy. Also, notice any reluctance to start a study session and use the NASA rocket metaphor to propel you into the studying and workspace. And finally, be mindful of distractions around you, as they have a high cost for the quality and quantity of learning. So I think it was a really fascinating conversation. Huge thank you to Bradley. Remember to take a listen to our two other exam-related podcasts where we talk about exam stress and what to do about it. That's episode 65. And 66. This is a real speciality of Elizabeth, and so she has plenty of really great insight to share with you in those episodes. Please share this content with others and help us to spread the word about this podcast. And please go and follow this podcast on your app of choice. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the next episode. Meanwhile, we wish you a really great and productive week. Bye-bye for now. And now for the legal bits. The information contained in this podcast is for information purposes only. The content is not intended to act as a substitute for professional advice. Please do not delay in seeking professional help for any medical or mental health condition. Use of the information in this podcast and associated materials is at the user's own risk.